Talk given Saturday, 17th June, 1978. This afternoon, let us first reconsider the meaning of the word religion and the term religious living. There are two Latin verbs which are the origin of which are the root of our English word religion. Cicero used the verb re-legere, and re-legere means to gather together or collect again. Note carefully, to gather together or collect again. That is re-legere. And he talks about this in one of his very profound works, the De Deorum Natura, that is his tract on the nature of the gods. Cicero was not merely a great orator. He was a really profound philosopher. To gather together or to collect again. Now, of course, other meanings of gathering together and collect again are all limited meanings, confined to objects, to things, or to people who have met in a particular place, a collection of people. But we regard all of them as separate objects, separate people. What is this gathering together? When there is the true and the full gathering together, we haven't just picked out this, that, or the other separate individual or object and put it in a particular place and we are all gathered together. Of course, that's the common phrase we use, simply because we are isolatively and separatively self-conscious. See, this gathering together implies the full awareness in each individual of the complete interrelationship with everyone else. The interrelationship, an awareness of the interrelationship, not simply in terms of ideas, concepts, or words, because that is very, very superficial. It is a felt thing to start with, a wholly felt thing, and far more than that, because feeling feeling produces emotion as well as being associated with thought. This goes right beyond feeling and thought. It is a state of isness, of being, this one unity, just a unity. And if that inner awareness is there, then you don't know it. That's a funny thing to say. But you see, the usual analogy given for these things, the iceberg. The tip of the iceberg is only 1/10 of the whole iceberg. The rest is invisible. That which is there is something which is an of course. It's not something which you need to work for, to strive for. It is not something for which you have to direct your energies to maintain and preserve. It is the living fact. You see? And if that living fact is not has no force, no energy going out of us which tries to disrupt or contradict or hurt that living fact, it is there effortlessly, naturally, spontaneously. And then it functions in its entire perfection and fullness, which means that it functions divinely, transcendentally, all the time. There is no separation between what we call transcendent and what we regard as not transcendent. What we regard as perfect and what is in actual fact sometimes, at least partly, imperfect. See, there is no conflict there. It is the natural state. And when a group of people experience and live in that state of harmony, by live I mean their innermost awareness, the unknowing awareness, is absolutely at home in it, then that is the gathering together. You know how often I have said that one of the meanings, one of the least misleading meanings of the Sanskrit word samadhi is the supreme togetherness. The supreme togetherness. It is not a state of abstraction into some mystical, airy-fairy realm which is separate from the total reality. This is where people have made such awful mistakes with regard to meditation and practicing meditation and seeking meditation teachers and all the rest of it. You see? Samadhi, sang, adhi, adhi, the supreme, the topmost, sung together with. You see, the supreme togetherness. You are not merely rejoined as a separate entity to the whole, to the supreme, because then you maintain in some part of your consciousness the sense of separateness. I am one with the totality, or with God, or Brahman, or whatever you call it. In your awareness, there is the separation. This is where it is not the meditative state, the true meditative state. And people don't realize that. And particularly in those parts of the world where the consciousness of individuality is very powerful, individuality in the sense of I am I, a separate person, you see, and I want to express myself this way and that way. Especially in such parts of the world, it is extremely difficult for the person to be able to be free of the limitations imposed upon him by this consciousness of separate ego. It's not ego which is the trouble. It is the separateness which is the trouble. See, supreme togetherness. And religion means that. Religiousness and religious living in Cicero's form means to be together, to be in the state of unity, without saying, ah, now we are all in the state of the unity, what nice people we are. Smarm ourselves. And, you know, the usual backslapping and buttering each other sort of nonsense. If that can take place, then there is no such thing as a friend or a relation who is a friend or relation because you and he can get on together. You are nice to each other. And there is no such thing as an enemy, on the other hand, you see, who is against you. All those petty distinctions of friend and enemy have vanished. Think out the effect of this sort of thing on mankind. Supposing you, who do experience, at least to some degree, this unity, this inward unity, in the supreme sense, some of you may have experienced it, you see. If this spirit spreads and grows in the world, what sort of a world will we have? We'll have a world where, in relation to the species called man, we shall have the most extraordinary state of transcendence manifesting unique individual perfected manhood through the thousands of millions of men and women who compose the human race. What do you think will happen to our politics, our economics, our social structures, our educational systems, our problems of health and illness, because those things will come physically. Because nature sometimes throws things at you, you see. And we can't avoid those. Volcanoes, earthquakes, all that sort of thing will happen. How will human beings respond to the natural physical processes of life? They'll respond to it humanly, and there'll be infinitely less unnecessary suffering and sorrow in the world caused by each and every one of us. You see? Now, this is not the healing of sorrow, the assuaging of pain in terms of a mere countermeasure or a mere palliative or a mere display of emotion, however sincerely felt. There's something infinitely deeper and greater than all that working, something of immeasurable transcendent power. But you see, the spirit is the root of it all. If the vision which is natural to you, your whole being sees, not just your two eyes, which will see only a limited portion of life, but complete vision will be there, and that will have immeasurable consequence for good, the real good, which you and I don't know. Always bear that in mind. Don't seek to formulate the good. You will see the trends of life. And when you really see the trends of life, in the full sense, you become wholly awake to them. And you will naturally respond to them. It's the naturalness and the spontaneity which marks the real thing. All the rest is a cloak. It is a put-on thing. The intellect says, this is beautiful, this is wonderful, oh, I must do it. Now, you know what makes one say that? Because the intellect sees it, or because one's emotions merely see it? I, Diego, I'm a good fellow. I always do the right thing. In fact, I'm always right. I'm never wrong. If I am in disagreement with anybody else, isn't that so? We are all so wonderfully clever that we are unimaginably foolish. Now, there is another definition also, a derivation of the word religion, which again comes out in Latin, Servius Lactantius and St. Augustine derive the word religion, religio, the Latin religio, from re ligare, Cicero from re legere, and these three use re ligare, which means to bind back or to fasten. Now they used those meanings, at least those meanings were given to the word re ligare. When one takes that phrase to bind back, naturally we are so conditioned, and not unjustifiably, we think, well, it is associated with the idea of bondage. We've got to be bound to this. When we take a vow, when we make a promise, we are bound in the sense of bondage, not in the sense of freedom. Isn't that so with us? All right. But what is the real deep meaning of binding in this situation? Because we are conscious in terms of self and not self, conscious in terms of isolativeness and separativeness, which are the fundamental roots of conflict and misery and the ill state in our life, because we are like that, we haven't the sense of integration. Now, integration is a fairly modern word. This is why the development of science, mathematics, and philosophy is a great help in enabling us human beings to see. We are truth, the realization of truth is concerned, there is no such thing as progress or development, because truth is immeasurable. But where the power to see the truth is concerned, we are helped through the development of our knowledge of the nature of things, the nature of process in the universal becoming process. You see? So, integration is a fairly modern word and concept. Integration means livingly growing into. An integration takes place there, which is different from a mechanical putting together, screwing it up with nuts and bolts and whatnot and making a structure, because that can always be unscrewed. But that which has once truly, livingly integrated, can never be taken backwards. You all know, when you were 3 and 4, you were like that. Had you any conception when you were 3 and 4 that by the time you were 20, 30, 40, I'll stop there. By the time you were 20, 30, 40, you'd grow into what you have grown into? Not the slightest conception. You couldn't picture it, could you? So you see, our very bodies in their growth are marvelous teachers. They are teachers in the true sense, because we are learning. Do remember, to be a disciple means to be a learner. But if you don't learn, the so-called teacher is unable to teach. By your learning, you confer teacherhood upon any and every individual through whom you happen to learn, and upon any single object or event or procedure through which you learn, because you are growing, living. And it's a process by which one comes to fruition. I said one comes to fruition. But one comes to fruition because you, the separate you, having become unresisting, unobstructive to transcendence itself, that fills your being and manifests itself, the whole reality in perfection, which spells your fruition. The fulfillment of the finite, the mortal, is due to the freedom, the perfection with which the infinite, the immortal, works freely through you. You see, these things are not just thoughts. They are expressed in terms of thoughts, of course, because otherwise we can't communicate unless all of us had developed to that extent where mind can communicate with mind without the spoken word, without the formulated concept. But I'm afraid I'm nowhere near there. So I can't convey something to you directly, mind to mind. Please do realize that this direct communication of mind to mind, this transmission which can take place between two, this spiritual transmission, is not just what we call telepathy or any such thing. Oh no, it's something infinitely more profound than that. That is why that last weekend in March, those of you who were here, I did talk of the Elijah-Elisha account in the Bible. And there are similar accounts in the Upanishads and in the Buddhist teachings and so forth. One outstanding example of that is when the Buddha holds up a flower as a symbol and Kashyapa smiles. An extraordinary transmission took place. The symbols, it has come down to us in symbolical terms. But it is quite possible that the Buddha never did hold up a flower and Kashyapa never smiled. But that direct transmission took place because in the innermost depths of awareness, the unity was a reality in the supreme sense, you see. So this Elijah-Elisha story is one of the finest presentations that I have come across in the scriptures of just this kind of transmission, direct transmission, for which I have sometimes used the phrase spiritual induction. Spiritual induction, you see. So, re ligare. This is the sort of thing that is meant by the phrase to bind back or to fasten together. Nothing mechanical. If it is mechanical, the two separate things remain separate still and can be separated again. But if there is the real unity, you have grown into it, and there is inseparability. You see? Now, try and when you are by yourself, let the mind dwell quietly upon this. Let the ideas, the words disappear. If the mind dwells quietly and you don't fall asleep or feel somnolent, because then you lost it, you see, but you're really alert inside, fully awake inside, without just being active with the process of musing, of thinking and so forth as we call it, then real vision will come to you. It will emerge out of you. You know, they have sometimes used this phrase, the light in the head bursts forth. And they have used another phrase, the third eye, and so on, and all that, and associated it with the pituitary body and so forth. But forget all that. Those are convenient ways of talking. That's all. But the process, the actuality which takes place in a dimension of being and awareness where there are no pituitary glands or any such thing. Similarly, in the yoga system, when they talk of chakras and nadis and so forth, those are convenient ways of talking. The underlying reality is transcendent, not subject to conceptual or verbal or pictorial representation, re-presentation. You see, the photograph of a person is not the living person. Although it helps you by using your physical eyes and looking at it to recognize the person when you see him. But at our physical level, we don't make the mistake, some of us do, I'm afraid, of mistaking the appearance of the person as the reality of the person. Anyhow, so re ligare, to bind back and to fasten. Think of it in terms of the restored integration of totality itself. Not God and I, or the Atma and I, or any such thing. But the restoration of the integrated reality. You will see, therefore, that if you get this sense of the livingness of the whole thing, that there is not a mechanical process, you will see at once that commandments, the laid down moralities, the laid down techniques of behavior, of dealing with your thought processes, your feelings and all the rest of it, they play their part only at the earliest level, in the earliest stages. They are the kindergarten only. You have to grow out of them. You can't remain in the kindergarten for all your days. If you do, you'll have a little bit of a problem earning your living when you're adult physically. Isn't that so? So it's like that, up to a point at least, where the inner life, the life which brings the human being to full human fruition, is concerned. And that means growing, as we have already seen, but there is this. If it is that kind of growing, which is true religious living, which is perfect human living, you grow happily. See, you can't seek happiness, therefore. As I said, when you were 3 or 4, you had no conception as to what the body will grow into. In the same way, in the inner depths of our being, the non-physical aspect of, the non-material aspect of our being, everything that happens is a mystery. We don't know anything about. If we define happiness and try to pursue it, we shall most successfully sow the seeds of conflict and misery and illness and sorrow and all the rest of it. You see, the great teachers were concerned with our well-being and happiness in the supreme sense of those words. And it is that supreme sense that we don't understand. And this is where study, considering together in the right way, considering together, paying total attention and being well aware of what is happening in terms of what comes to us from outside and in terms of what our brain reactions and feelings are. See? I mean, the teachings of the great teachers are in utterly simple terms, and it's that very simplicity that defeats us all along the line. Until there comes the time when suddenly one ceases to be a chick which goes round and round inside its eggshell but just gives it a little peck and bursts forth into the world. Totally new state. Well, try and recall when we were only embryos or just growing inside mum's tummy. We had no conception of what on earth the outer world is like. One fine day, suddenly, it happened. And we had an awful to-do about it. It is a life and death struggle, actually. But there is the simultaneity of life and death in that struggle. A simultaneity of which we are unconscious. Those are moments of the realization of the experiencing of eternity, of the two processes, the anabolic building up and the catabolic breaking down, taking place simultaneously like that. It happens again at the death of the body. Between those two points, you can here and now grow into the realization of eternity. If you live fully humanly, fully religiously. We have talked about these things in different forms through the years, but it's very hard to understand in the deep sense. When one understands in the deep sense, it remains something permanent with you without your trying to hold it, to keep it and abide by it. It abides in you. You see? So, you grow happily when they talk about Brahman as being consciousness, bliss. The word bliss is the least understood. We think of it as sensation, as pleasure, as something which makes us feel fine and so forth. There is bliss in the supreme pain and misery and sorrow. Also, this is known by one who is the real martyr. The real martyrdom is a supremely blissful state and experiencing. The real supreme togetherness, the real samadhi, is also that same bliss interpreted by us in terms which are in contradistinction to the other state. Death, where is thy sting? Grave, where is thy victory? Or, you know the words. It's like that in life, here and now. If this spirit infuses us and we just go on quietly and simply with everyday life from moment to moment, these things become realities which have quite unforeseeable influences upon the whole of the human race. You know how when Jesus was crucified, I mention Jesus because his is the most dramatic example. I'm assuming that the crucifixion was an actual physical fact. When Jesus was crucified, you see, and the disciples ran away and all the rest of it, who remained by his side? The women looked upon it. This is what makes me feel that the story is symbolical. His mother was there. And the other Mary, that was Mary Magdalene, wasn't it? The converted, the transformed, and therefore transfigured prostitute. Think of it, the tremendous significance of it all. And John was there, the beloved disciple. Only the beloved disciple, none of the others. Think of the significances involved in that. See, that was the supremely blissful state, that crucifixion. There is much more that one could talk about. But I think we better stop there now. Just one last sentence. Therefore, see the trends of life. See for yourselves. Let your own vision awake and abide by it. Not hold on to it, but livingly abide by it, which means changingly abide by it, which means growingly abide by it, and growing happily.